Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Michelle Florcruz. As we close out a tumultuous and unpredictable year, the arrival of 2021 brings a number of pressing questions. What might life in Asia look like after the pandemic? And what should we expect from the continent's perennial hotspots, from North Korea to Afghanistan, Iran to the South China Sea? For our final episode of Asia in Depth in 2020, five experts reflect on the past year and make predictions on what 2021 will look like across the Asia Pacific. We hear from investor and author Wei Jianshan, Afghanistan media executive Saad Mosseini, Korea analyst Sue Mee Terry, journalist Bobby Ghosh, and strategist and economist Stephen Englander. The conversation was moderated by Asia Society's Executive Vice President Tom Nagorski. He begins the conversation.
So to begin our look at Asia in 2021 and what the year ahead may bring, we go first to Hong Kong. And if we can bring in Wei Jianshan, who is joining us from Hong Kong, a great friend of the Asia Society. Sean has appeared at events with about a half dozen of our global centers now in person and a couple of times this year virtually. Wei Jianshan is chairman and CEO of PAG, a Hong Kong-based private equity firm. Before that, partner at TPG, and before that, a managing director of JP Morgan, and assistant professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Sean is the author of two memoirs, the first of which, Out of the Gobi, My Story of China and America, I can tell you is a masterpiece and a very compelling story of his journey from his years as a teenager in the Gobi Desert during the Cultural Revolution, and how he wound up ultimately at the pinnacle of his field. Sean, it's great to have you with us again. And we asked all our participants for just some, without giving it away to me, what the prime areas they'd each like to focus on for their forecast for 2021. Sean, you've chosen a pretty fundamental, perhaps the most fundamental question that we have at the moment for Asia, which is what the economic recovery may look like. And we know that in some places in Asia, it's already underway, China in particular. But let's begin with that broad question. What do you see the economic recovery looking like in the year ahead? Where are the areas where you have the greatest optimism? And then maybe we'll come around to the challenges and trouble spots after that. Sean?
Tom, thank you very much for having me here. My recollection is a little different from yours. You say that I suggested the subject. I thought you ordered me to do so. But in any case, I remember that the famous economist John Kenneth Galbraith once said that there are two types of forecasters. One type, those who don't really know. And the other type, those who don't know that they don't know. I think I'm the first type. It's exceedingly difficult, as you have pointed out, to predict the future. Nonetheless, I think we can ask the question, if the current trend continues, what the future will look like. And for some events, we also know that there are certain causal effects. For example, we know that the vaccines will eventually stop the pandemic. And it seems that in all probability, the vaccines will become widely available by probably summer or autumn of next year, and therefore that is probably the time when the pandemic will be stopped or disappear. And meanwhile, I think we can look at the trend in different countries to think about if such trends continue, how the economies will look like. And if I'm correct, the U.S. economy at this moment is actually in the second dip. I think there was a first dip back in the second quarter, then there was some recovery, then the pandemic became worsened, and then I think at this moment, we are experiencing a second dip. But in all probability, American economy is likely to recover throughout the next year, but won't recover fully probably towards the end of last year when vaccine really stopped the pandemic. I looked at a study by IMF, which suggests that the US economy will recover to 2019 level in 2022. So next year will be the year of recovery with the vaccine, the advent of vaccine. I hope we can avoid a third dip. If you look at Asia, of course, the largest economy in Asia is China. And China's economic recovery is suspected to continue. In fact, the recovery started in the second quarter. In the first quarter of this year, the Chinese economy came down by 6.8% from the same period of last year. And that was, of course, induced by the lockdowns. In the second quarter of this year, the Chinese economy grew by 3.2% from last year. And in the third quarter, the growth rate has gone up to 4.9%. And it is widely expected that this recovery will continue. The consensus among the economists and research institutions is that the Chinese economy is likely to grow by about 8% from relatively low base of this year, next year. And the IMF, the same study, which predicted that the US economy will recover to the same level of 2019 by 2022, suggested that the Chinese economy will grow by about 10% from 2019. By 2022. I think that's likely to be the case unless there are big surprises. And the reason that China has been recovering so strongly so far in the past three quarters is because the pandemic is very much under control. In fact, China has practically eliminated the virus. It will have to test its vaccine in foreign countries because you won't be able to find subjects in the country. So assuming that the situation is under control and assuming that vaccines will help restore some international travel, I think the economic recovery trend is expected to continue. Other countries in Asia will fare differently. Vietnam this year will be probably the second country in the world after China to register a positive growth because the pandemic is very much kept outside of its door. India, on the other hand, is in much worse shape. And I don't expect the Indian economy to even recover to the 2019 level by the end of next year. Right now, of course, India is still experiencing negative growth. And I think next year, it will come out of the pandemic, assuming vaccines become available in that country very slowly. But I think the recovery probably will take about 2 years. Let me just stop here in case I spend too much time and see if you have any other questions.
No, it's super helpful. And by the way, I mean, you made a point that I think we all know, but it's mind-boggling when you sit here in the United States to think that China has done so well in terms of eradicating or coming close to beating the virus that they don't have enough patients to participate in some of these vaccine studies. That's certainly not a problem we have here. But the way you paint the picture, Sean, I mean, you make a pretty basic point that recovery depends really on pandemic-related issues, right? How countries dealt with the lockdown and then the prospects for vaccine. I wonder if I can ask you, because we've had another little event in the world, which is Joe Biden's election. And much has been made about, you talk about predictions. There are a lot of people predicting a lot of things in terms of whether a Joe Biden administration is going to have much of an impact or an effect on the U.S.-China relationship. Some saying, well, you know, you have more stability. You have someone who values, a potentially better U.S.-China relationship, and maybe just more competence at the level of those who will be dealing with it. To what extent do you think a Biden administration will impact economic issues for China in particular? Or is it just is China going to sail along at those levels, no matter what the new policies? And of course, there are those who say Biden's going to be equally tough on China as Trump was. How much does that matter?
Oh, I think it matters a great deal. China and the United States are each other's biggest trading partners. So, the economic dependence between the two countries is very substantial. And the relationship, economic relationship, has been at a nadir at this particular point in 40 years, with, of course, in the past 2 years, the trade war, and then followed by technology war, and to some extent, the financial war as well. I don't think that the economic relationship will improve immediately under the Biden administration, but I would expect the relationship, as you just indicated, to become more stable, more predictable. Even if Biden's policy or the policies of the Biden administration towards China remain tough, I would expect it to be consistent and stable. The United States for the past half century has had a rather consistent foreign policy, except I think in the past 4 years, when the policy became somewhat unpredictable. I would think that the policy will return to predictability and to stability under the Biden administration. Another thing is that I would expect the Biden administration to work more with international institutions, which really form the framework of the world economic order. Institutions like the World Bank, IMF, WTO, various trade agreements with Mexico, with Canada, with Europe, and so forth. So to the extent that the Biden administration is willing to be multilateral, is willing to work within the framework of international institutions, I think that would improve the economic relationship with China, because China is very much willing to work within that framework as well.
Okay. I have one last question, and maybe a brief answer to this one, Sean, for you. And I think I know how you feel about this, but Hong Kong itself has had a rough year in many ways. But from a financial standpoint, which is the area in which you work, do you see Hong Kong's position, long-standing position, as a great free financial center compromised in any way, given what's happened with the national security law, with other actions of the mainland, or is it business as usual going forward, do you think?
In fact, Hong Kong didn't have a tough year this year, as it did last year. Last year was really bad, especially in the second half of last year, when there was violent unrest on the streets, when many businesses were forced, including schools, were forced to shut down, including ours. So in the second half of last year, Hong Kong economy already went into a recession when the rest of the world was booming. Chinese economy last year grew 6.1%, American economy 2.3%, mm-hmm. and yet Hong Kong economy went into a recession because tourists were turned away. In the second half of last year, tourism dropped 38%, led by a 40.8% drop in the number of tourists from the mainland. And Hong Kong's economy depends on tourism. Basically, there are two sectors, financial services, and then everything related to tourism. So when tourists go away or don't come to Hong Kong, of course, the economy suffers. This year, the stability has returned, especially after the national security law is enacted or was enacted back in July. The financial sector was never much affected because the financial sector doesn't really depend on the local economy. If you look at the stock exchange of Hong Kong, which is about $5 trillion in market cap altogether, about 80% of the listed companies are not domiciled or don't operate in Hong Kong. They are from China and elsewhere. The local economy continues to do very poorly this year because this year, tourism is even more down than last year. Last year, it was 40-some percent. This year, it's almost 100% or 90-some percent. So the economy, local economy, is in doldrums. And I expect the local economy to do very poorly in the foreseeable future. But the financial market has been booming this year, like elsewhere in the world, you know, in New York, in London. And the stock market, for example, 3 months ago, I would tell you is $4 trillion. Now it's $5 trillion. Mm-hmm. And many companies come to Hong Kong for public listing and there are issuance of bonds as well. And I would expect Hong Kong's financial market to continue to thrive next year and in the years to come.
Okay, Wei Jin Shan, we're going to need to leave it there with you, but thank you so much for joining us in the evening, your time in Hong Kong. Let's go west now to Dubai, where we find our friend Saad Mousseini. Saad is chairman and chief executive of the Mobi Group. He founded Tolo News, the first 24-hour news network in his native Afghanistan a little over 15 years ago. Saad Mousseini is an alumnus of the Asia 21 Young Leaders Network, recipient of our 2013 Asia Game Changer Award, and currently serves on the boards of the International Crisis Group and the International Center for Journalists. Saad, great to have you with us. You offered us three very different predictions, and I'll just maybe give the thumbnail and perhaps you can do the deeper dive. On foreign policy, you said that you expected, quote, a more responsible approach to issues, and not just from the United States, but also more toned down rhetoric and actions from China, Russia, and Turkey. So I guess that's good news. Can you explain why and where we think we're going to be getting a more responsible approach to policy questions in Asia?
Well, I think I would almost cut and paste Sean's messages, but in a sort of political context. I think that the what we've witnessed, in particular in a place like Afghanistan and the Middle East, where we have quite a large presence, is that because the administration, in particular the White House, was so disengaged and not particularly caring, others stepped in, and the vacuum provided all the opportunists in the region and beyond with sort of a couple of years to do the sorts of things that they wanted to do, whether it was Iran and Syria or the Russians elsewhere or the Turks in the Caucasus. And of course, the GCC and Yemen, something they had started during the Obama tenure, but they continued, and others in Africa. I think they made the most of it. I think in a new environment, they may be more reluctant to do so. Having said that, I think there's going to be more responsibility. But I'm not sure how effective the Americans will be. I'll give you one example. With Afghanistan, the Americans, obviously the State Department and their special envoy for Afghan reconciliation, Khalilzad, a career diplomat, stepped in, negotiated a fairly interesting deal with the Taliban, where the Taliban would reduce violence, the Americans would start to draw down, the two Afghan sides would sit, and the Americans have a timeline of, like, you know, 12 months plus to draw down if certain conditions were met. President Trump all of a sudden decided he was going to pull all the troops out and announced so in October of this year. Now, that put the diplomats in a bit of a bind, obviously, because that there goes their leverage. Now, somehow, you know, we've seen Trump reassess a little bit and the troops will go down to about 2,500. But on January the 20th, Biden will be faced with a very, very difficult decision. 2,500 troops are not quite enough to have maintained enough leverage over the Taliban so they could go and negotiate a peace deal. And because of the sensitivity to continuing these endless wars, he's not going to be able to increase the number of troops on the ground. So as much as he may wish to do things differently, he has to deal with a situation that he's inherited from President Trump. Similarly in Iran, I mean, I think time has moved on. Obama probably was a little bit too desperate to negotiate the deal that he negotiated with the Iranians. But today in Iran, it's far more radicalized than it was. The liberals no longer have the leverage. They no longer have the momentum. They probably no longer have the popularity. So I'm not sure how much more he can do in a place like or with the Iranians, for example. The GCC countries, the Saudis and the Emiratis, have taken things into their own hands. They have a peace deal with the Israelis. They're far more active in the region, certainly far more active in Central Asia and South Asia than they were 4 years ago. So, yes, it's good to have a grown-up in the room with the Biden administration. But again, I'm not sure how much more they can do. So it's going to be we're going to have a more responsible team in the White House, but I'm not sure how much more effective because after 4 years of a fairly irresponsible administration, there's only so much you can roll back. So I think that obviously we're all relieved that we have a more more responsible team in DC, but at the same time we have to manage our expectations. I think there's only so much they can do, and some things will take a long time to fully reverse. The multilateral arrangements and the relationships are very important, whether it's with the environment, for us, more importantly, with NATO, and of course, all the trade deals. These are all important. And I hope Sean's right that we can more engaged world and more responsible approach to things is going to bode well for a whole range of things, the environment, security, and trade and so forth. But I'm still concerned. I mean, I still have deep concerns over the potential for further conflict. If the Americans draw down very quickly in my home country of Afghanistan, there's no doubt that the Iranians will step in. The Russians may need to step in. The Pakistanis have always been in there. The Iranians will step in, the Indians and so forth. It just means that more complications for our region.
So you put a lot on the table, and thank you, Saad. But just to stick with Afghanistan for one more moment, obviously, Joe Biden, as hamstrung as he may be, he's been through this discussion before, right? I mean, he basically was in the room when, in the early days and even not so early days of the war in Afghanistan. And so he's presumably quite aware of the issues that you raise. What do you think, where do you think he's likely to land in that conundrum of you can't really produce more or add more troops to the mix, but being well aware as he is and his security team is about the risks of actually following through with a full withdrawal?
Well, I if you listen to people like, his main security, national security folks, his main advisors during the campaign, you'd hear that we want to draw down, but we want to obviously engage with residual forces. We want to ensure that Afghanistan it doesn't turn into another hub for terrorists. It's easier said than done because the Americans have signed an agreement with the Taliban that they are going to fully disengage by May of 2021. And the Taliban actually yesterday stated that if the Americans stay beyond May, even if they have five individuals, then it's open season as far as international troops are concerned. So this is a dilemma for Team Biden. I think Biden was never a firm believer in a large presence in Afghanistan, but he also sees the risks in terms of drawing down very quickly. My sense is that they're going to come in and they're going to quickly use the 3 or 4 months that they have left in terms of their agreement with the Taliban to push for a peace deal. But it sounds like a bit of a Hail Mary pass from their side. And, you know, Tony and Jacob, you know, very responsible individuals. I mean, they're very engaged. They're not the sort of isolationist type individuals that, you know, over the years we've seen what they've said and how they've talked about different issues. But I still think that they're going to have their hands tied behind their backs in terms of what they can do.
Now, speaking of hands tied behind their backs, on Iran, you raise a really interesting point in your first answer, which, here it's very common and, to hear people, political analysts here in the United States say, oh, here are the things that the Biden administration is going to try to reverse or re-engage on. And they list the Paris Climate Accords, they list the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and then the Iran deal. But as you say, just because the United States may wish, or a new administration may wish to do so, speak if you could from the perspective of Iran, which, as you said, has radicalized since then. Let's say, for argument's sake, that Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden want to reengage. Jake Sullivan was deeply involved, of course, in the deal itself. What are the pitfalls to re-engagement, given where Iran stands right now? I mean, how would that even work?
I think, and that's my personal opinion, and we obviously observe Iran from Afghanistan, which is right next door. There's a certain naivete in Washington, certainly during the Obama administration, that they could will this deal into happening. They executed a deal which they thought would stop Iran. I personally have never believed that the Iranians will fully abide by whatever agreement they signed 5 or so years ago. But now it's even worse because you have an angry, more belligerent Iran. It's not going to fully trust Washington, but at the same time, it may view the very people who negotiated the last deal as weak. So it's the worst of the two combinations. They're dealing with this, the previous team, which they never probably had much respect for, and at the same time, they're angry. And of course, the very people you dealt with, the likes of Zarif and others, are no longer, as strong, or they probably never were that strong, but they have even less leverage today. And I've got elections coming up in Iran. It's very doubtful that the liberals or the moderates will emerge. I mean, even the word moderates probably not the right term to use for these people. So I just think it's wishful thinking to assume we're going to go back to where we were 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. Last one for you, Sean. Saad, if you can keep this one brief. It's probably hard to keep brief, but you seem a bit more bearish on the prospects for an economic recovery. Perhaps that's because of where you sit in Western corners of Asia, but explain that if you would.
Well, I just think that, and I think Sean made an interesting point that assuming that everything's going to be okay, that we're going to have enough vaccines and we don't have another strain of the virus come up and so forth, assuming all of those things, then we're going to be to sort of 2019 levels by 2021. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking. I mean, I think for everything to go right, which we all want, we're assuming that nothing else will go wrong. There's no conflict. There are no major environmental disasters. There are no other strains of the coronavirus. But again, I'm getting back to politics. I think, with trillions of dollars pumped into the different economies, the world that has, again, less leverage. I mean, you look at the Brits who consistently have tied their aid to their GDP growth. All of a sudden they've stated that they're not going to be as engaged and they're not going to be as helped, in terms of aid and so forth. That's also going to be problematic from where we stand. For example, if the Americans or the Brits are the biggest contributors to Pakistan, they're going to have far less leverage. So I think a sort of a faltering economy, which is always possible, in combination with what's been going on over the last 4 years, is a pretty bad combination. You have an international community with less leverage and things potentially going wrong. And of course, Bobby and others will talk about India. You know, this could be the sort of the calm before the storm, I'm afraid to say.
Oh boy, that to hear at the end of 2020 that it's the calm before the storm is a tough note to end on, but I take your point. Saad Mohseini, thank you. We'll come back around with you and the group in a moment. Let's go now to Sumi Terry, joining us also from here in New York. Sue is Senior Fellow for Korea at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also a frequent guest on our platform. She teaches at the Asian Studies Program at Georgetown University, and prior to her tenure at CSIS, Sumi Terry was a senior analyst on Korean issues at the CIA for several years. Sue, you have sent a crystal ball filled with predictions, several of them, and I'll just maybe mention a few, but we'll dive into the Korea-related ones, if that's okay. Sue sent a couple of domestic predictions that domestic U.S. that have major overseas implications. One, that the Democrats here will not win those two Georgia Senate races, which are happening in a few weeks' time. Obviously, the implications there are serious for the Biden administration, because unless they win those two, they don't hold the Senate. The Biden administration will, to pick up on things we've already talked about a little bit, move to re-enter the Iran deal or reinstate it and rejoin the Paris Climate Accords, but not the TPP. And then Sumi Terry sent a couple of items on the lighter side, that the movie industry, which has been so battered in 2020, will not only survive but thrive as the rebound begins in 2021, and that the Tokyo 2020 games will indeed go on, as Sue says, with vaccinated crowds in attendance. So those would be some good news items. But Sue, let's come around to the main focal point of your expertise, the Korean Peninsula. You had several thoughts on that. Begin wherever you wish on that front.
Thanks, Tom. Let me just start with North Korea. So I think first and foremost, what's going to be different under President Biden is that, obviously all the pageantry, all the drama, all the theatrics, and all the exchange of love letters with Kim Jong-un would go out the door. I'm not saying that Biden is not going to meet with Kim Jong-un, or that he's going to shut the door down to diplomacy. I think actually the opposite is going to be true. It's just that summitry would not be his first priority. So he's going to return to more of a traditional working level diplomacy, empowering negotiators. When President Trump thought he was really the best person to directly negotiate with Kim. But my prediction is also that President-elect Biden will launch a nuclear freeze arms control negotiations with North Korea, possibly. And why do I say this? I think it's because, first, North Korea is now in a possession of nuclear arsenal that is more advanced than ever before. And President-elect Biden will be the first American president to enter the office since North Korea demonstrated that it has a missile capable of hitting U.S. mainland, which means the incoming Biden administration actually has less leverage today, I believe, than even Trump had in Singapore or in Hanoi, because today North Korea has amassed 20 to 30 nuclear warheads. They continue to churn out fissile material. Pyongyang has conducted some 30 ballistic missile tests since just Hanoi summit. And at the October 10th parade, which celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Ruling Workers' Party of Korea, we saw enormous advancement in their nuclear missile program. Well, they paraded this two massive new sea and ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, including this monster-sized Hwasong-16, this new strategic weapon that Kim Jong-un himself had promised that the world would see earlier this year. And this, the capabilities of this Hwasong-16 is such that not only does it have long-range capability of hitting the entire U.S. mainland, it has this very large advanced payload section. So I'm just saying the Biden administration is just going to have less leverage. So it could be that they are more realistic about what to do about North Korea and be open to this step-by-step approach that Tony Blinken and others have advocated, and be open to this interim deal with North. In fact, Tony Blinken has penned a New York Times op-ed piece that he thought the best possible model for a nuclear deal with North Korea is the JCPOA with Iran. So, you know, in any interim deal, what would it include? You know, the North ceasing further production of fissile material, you know, putting limit to existing stockpile and closing down Yongbyon. And of course, a critical question there is whether to grant what they have to grant partial or how much of sanctions relief to grant in return for a pledge to cap. Because, you know, North Korea's obviously all other agreements have fallen, you know, they fell apart over verification. And that's going to be also a key challenge, too, over verification that North Koreans are probably not going to agree to, or it just that's always have been a problem in the past.
We're going to take a short break here to tell you about Asia Society Magazine, an exciting new annual print publication featuring writing, data visualization, and photography that provides an in-depth look at the year that was in Asia and beyond. This year's issue, titled The Year No One Saw Coming, tackles the subjects that dominated headlines throughout 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic, and racial justice. It features contributions from a wide range of authors, artists, politicians, journalists, business people, and public intellectuals. You can read the digital version or buy the print edition at asiasociety.org/magazine. That's asiasociety.org/magazine. Now let's get back to the conversation.
So yet another place where the United States seems to arrive at this moment of transition with less leverage. Saad mentioned Afghanistan and Iran, and here we come to North Korea. Let me ask you what may count as a naive question, but I'll ask it anyway. There were those, I mean, obviously the results, as you say, Sue, of the summitry and the pageantry weren't great, right? I mean, I think any clear-eyed observer would say that. On the other hand, there were those at the time, and even since, who've said, look, a long, long stretch, I mean, successive administrations, both sides of approaches to North Korea yielded nothing. I mean, when Obama had that famous conversation with Trump, right? He spent a lot of time saying this is going to be the most dangerous thing that I'm leaving you with. So what is the interim approach you described notwithstanding? What's wrong with a smarter approach to summitry, given that it seems to, you know, at least on the disrupting a status quo that never seems to get us anywhere? What would you advise the new administration on the utility of such meetings? What would you say, you know, the Biden himself or the Secretary of State, you know, ought to demand or ask for before engaging in that kind of personal diplomacy again?
No, I don't think in theory it's, you know, I'm against summitry or having meet with Kim Jong-un. It's just that, you know, all of, you know, if you read of, you know, other folks' account about these summits, President Trump's side as much more, it was all about sort of media coverage and pageantry. It was not really concerned about substance. But you're right. I mean, this goes back to early 1990s, right? The Clinton administration, the two-term Bush administration, two-term Obama administration, we tried bilateral talks, you know, 1994 agreed framework, multilateral negotiations, the six-party talks under Bush, which produced 2005 agreement, 2007. And then President Obama, with strategic patience, for two terms, you know, what did it get us? So I'm not, in theory, opposed to trying to sit down with Kim Jong-un, but we have sat down with Kim Jong-un now three times. And what we got, and you on the October 10th parade, we've seen, I just listed out these things to you. They have made tremendous progress. So really nothing has been gained since Singapore. In fact, we're worse off. Meanwhile, Kim has, you know, gotten more, let's say, you know, recognition or sort of a legitimacy. We kind of legitimized him in a sense that, you know, President Xi Jinping has never met with Kim Jong-un until President Trump decided to meet with him, right? So that's the first time that President Xi met with him since Kim Jong-un came into power. When he met with South Korean president multiple times, he didn't meet with Kim. And now sanctions enforcement are lax. Chinese and the Russians are not really implementing sanctions. So I'm all for smart way of doing this. But I think this we have now also tried just rushing into a summitry. That's what I'm opposed to, just rushing into it. And I think what we have to really think about, and this interim deal, in theory, is not a bad idea because all or nothing approach is not working. And I'm pretty hard-nosed about North Korea. I'm Korea hard line, but I think it's time to think realistically also about how we approach North Korea. And again, all or nothing approach is not going to get us. So, you know, smart diplomacy, principled diplomacy that Biden talks about, you know, I'm not opposed to that.
Let me ask you a question before we go over to Bobby Ghosh, Sue, which is about COVID and North Korea. And this may be a very tough one to answer, but we had a discussion on this platform recently about the North, and there are signs now that after saying for a while that they didn't have a problem, that they have a pretty severe problem. Of course, like everything else there, it's hard to know. Do you think there's an opening, there's a window in any discussions with the North Koreans for, assuming they do have a problem, for adding that to the plate of things that can be discussed in terms of assistance? Well, first of all, what do you know about the situation there in those terms? And is that grounds for some sort of diplomacy on that front?
Well, first of all, you know, North Koreans continue to insist that they have no confirmed COVID case, which is extremely hard to believe. But what's really interesting is that North Koreans are very paranoid about COVID. So they are the first country to close border with China in January. And these preventive measures they've taken, closing off the border and so on, have completely decimated the economy, decimated tourism, the exports, imports. So these preventive measures have probably, you know, have greater impact on North Korea's economy than sanctions even. So we know that Kim Jong-un is paranoid about COVID, and we know that North Korea's economy is suffering. They were already suffering under the impact of sanctions. Then you add the COVID measures, and then they had a series of typhoons and floods and natural disasters. And now you've heard reports about North Korea hacking into AstraZeneca and, you know, six other companies trying to, you know, they hacked in, so they want vaccines. So I think your question is a very interesting one. I do think we need to explore whether it's a potential for a leverage in terms of negotiation, besides on the humanitarian front of helping them out with the vaccines. But yeah, Kim is very, very focused on Korea for somebody who says, you know, there's not a single person who's confirmed, who has confirmed case of COVID.
Right. I suppose I should have acknowledged that it's hard to help a country when the leader says there's no problem there. But Sumi, Terry, thanks. We'll come back around. You had some other interesting points, non-Korea related, that we can come to. But let's go next for predictions from our longtime friend, Bobby Ghosh, member of the executive committee of the Asia Society Global Council, columnist, member of the editorial board at Bloomberg, former international editor at Time, and ran the Hindustan Times in India for a while. He's currently based in London, where he joins us today. And Bobby is also a frequent commentator on foreign policy for MSNBC and CNN. Bobby, your forecast, I think, take us to South Asia, which we touched on just briefly with Saddam Husseini, beginning with India and what you suggest or believe will be some political and social turmoil coming, and as you said, perhaps tarnishing Narendra Modi's aura of invincibility. That, by the way, is something we have talked about here in previous iterations of this event. And Modi seems to escape the tarnishing by and large. What's going to be different in 2021, do you think?
Hi, Tom, and thank you for having me in this discussion. You know, you're right. The prime minister, his personal political stock does not seem to be greatly affected by the turmoil that's been taking place in India. But you have to think that there is a finite point to that, that at a certain point, that kind of resilience of his personal brand will crumble. And my hunch is that when it does, it'll sort of go off the side of a cliff rather than a sort of steady decline. We're seeing in India the pain of sort of long-term economic slowdown that's now been accelerated by the effects of the pandemic. And I agree with what Weijin Chan said earlier, which is that India doesn't look like it's going to make any kind of, it's been able to arrest this decline, never mind making a China-style comeback in the next couple of years. So the pain will deepen, and we've already begun to see some pushback from Indians against the sort of Modi-BJP political sort of juggernaut. So recently, in fact, they're still ongoing. Farmers, particularly in the northern part of the country, specifically from the big farming state of Punjab, have been agitating against some of Modi's policies. The agitations are against specific policies to do with price setting for grains, but there is a strong underlying factor, which is the state of the economy. If the economy was doing as well as it had 5, 7, 10 years ago, the farmers might not be this anxious about the pricing of their grains. They would have had much greater confidence in the market to make sure they got a good price. So that sort of begins to hint at a sort of rising anger at the economic situation among Indians. Let's not forget one of the most striking images of 2020 from India was the sight of hundreds of thousands, actually millions of poor and lower middle class Indians from the big urban agglomerations walking home, walking tens, hundreds of miles home to their villages because they had lost their jobs in the city thanks to COVID, because they had no expectation that they would receive any kind of benefit that would allow them to sustain their lifestyles. So they were retreating to their homes in the countryside, in the farmlands, from where they had initially fled to go to the city. So that those people carried back with them a sense of anger and disappointment. And I think we will see the exodus may have stopped because, frankly, there are not that many people left to go back. But the opportunities for them to come back into the cities and earn the living to sustain their families are not showing up. And until those opportunities come up again, that anger will fester and deepen and look for opportunities to express itself. Will it express itself directly at Modi? It's a $64,000 question. I suspect it will at least begin to in 2021.
And are there, Bobby, any, not to put you in a position of advising the prime minister, but I mean, what can he has had a great gift for whatever the circumstances are and the issues are. Here we sometimes refer to it as Teflon leadership or presidencies, where no matter what the problems are, certain leaders seem to be able to wangle their way out of them. But that combination that you describe of poor economic performance running smack into a really nasty, nasty case, almost as bad as ours here in the United States, of the pandemic. What levers does he have, or what tools in the toolbox to deal with this, to maybe mitigate against the prediction that you're making for him?
Well, I mean, you're right. He does have that Teflon quality. He's also, if this is the right word, blessed with a particularly incompetent opposition. And that has helped as well. Nobody has been able to capture this sense of disappointment in India's economy that many Indians feel. No political opponent of Modi's has been able to harness that and turn it into capital. And I think that is in part, that has informed the government's sort of rather poor response to COVID and a kind of lack of interest may not be the right word, but a lack of urgency in addressing the economic issues. I think there is a sense of overconfidence, self-satisfaction. The election victory from a couple of years ago was huge, and it allowed, I think, the BJP and the Prime Minister and people around him to feel like they were untouchable in the American sense, not the Indian one. And that you can see manifestations of that in the way the government has behaved since the start of the pandemic, and the response, which has been sort of almost desultory. In the beginning, there was it was very much like the response we saw in parts of the US, in Brazil. But once the science began to become clear that this could not be wished away, there was a response, but it was very poor. It was very poorly organized. All of the failings of the Indian government system that Modi has not addressed in the four and some years that he has been in power, the bureaucracy's inability to respond to crises like this, all of these things have now come to a head. Modi will have to steer the ship in a storm while conducting repairs to the hull, which would be incredibly difficult for any leader anywhere in the world, but all the more so for a leader who's never had to do this.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. So, Bobby, the other thing I want to raise is something you actually wrote in a piece for Bloomberg, I believe. Let me just read an excerpt. This has to do with other smaller countries and impacts that they've had as a result of the pandemic. You wrote that the pandemic will force countries that export labor and depend heavily on remittances to recalibrate their economies. As states that rely on foreign workers accelerate efforts towards self-reliance, the so-called, quote, remittance economies, unquote, will struggle to accommodate returning prodigals as well as new generations entering the workforce. This represents major challenges for Asian countries such as the Philippines, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. So it's a really interesting point that, you know, big countries get so concerned, given what's happened to supply chains and everything, they got to make everything themselves. But boy, that's a big domino effect. And talk about how you see that playing out in the year or maybe even years to come.
Well, I wrote a very long piece about this early in the year when the first wave of the pandemic was being sort of felt. In my day job at Bloomberg, I focus a lot of my attention on the Middle East and North Africa, and of course in the Middle East, in the oil the sheikdoms, foreign labor keeps those economies going, keeps the wells pumping, keeps home fires burning back home. So countries like India, Bangladesh, the Philippines, and Egypt, and others depend very heavily on remittances coming, not just from sort of for labor abroad, but specifically from labor in the Persian Gulf countries. Now, in the Persian Gulf countries, for several years now, governments have been talking about lowering their dependence. They've struggled to actually achieve this because their own populations don't always have the right mix of skills as well as a willingness to work for low salaries that the expat labor brings. But with COVID, the process of has accelerated. Two things have happened. First, the Gulf governments have basically sent home a lot of workers, hundreds of thousands, millions of workers have had to go back home. The Gulf economies were pretty shaken up early on, and a lot of jobs that previously existed for these people just went away, particularly in the service sector. Now, when the recovery really begins, and let's keep our fingers crossed that that happens in 2021, a lot of the governments in Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, and so on, have the opportunity to build a little bit from close to scratch and try to make sure that when jobs become available, that those jobs are made available to their own populations before the foreign labor is allowed back in. Many of these governments have sort of now got numbers. They have targets of what proportion of jobs have to be local, and they've also got targets for how many visas they will issue for foreign workers. And so for countries like Bangladesh, like India and the Philippines, this is a huge problem for two generations now. These countries have depended on remittances for tens of billions of dollars coming into the country every year, without really thinking very much about a rainy day. And guess what? It's raining now, and those governments have no plans in place to deal with this.
Well, thank you, Bobby Ghosh. And last, certainly not least, you've been very patient, Stephen Englander. We come back to business in the global economy, which is where we began this conversation. Stephen is head of global G10 FX research for Standard Chartered Bank. Before that, head of research for Rafiki Capital Management, which is an Asia-based hedge fund. And before that, Stephen Englander led G10 FX strategy at Citibank. He is a member of the Asia Society Business Council. Steve, it's great to have you with us. And you really come to some very core issues, super important in terms of the global economy, inflation, the U.S. dollar, and trade. And I couldn't help but notice my copy of The Economist arrived just the other day. There it is. I guess that's the one. Will inflation return? And, you know, I love The Economist, but they do a classic kind of hedging on it on the one hand, on the other hand, and I'm not really sure where they stand. So why don't we start with that? Are we going to have a return of inflation? Great if you can stick to Asia as much as possible, but your answer to that and then the implications, whatever your answer is.
Well, look, it's not in our forecasts. As previous speakers have mentioned, the lots of Asia is going to be struggling to recover to previous levels of activity, never mind kind of getting to levels that would generate inflation. Even China is, which seems to be ahead of, both in Asia and with respect to the rest of the world. We really don't see any serious inflation pressures emerging anytime soon. If anything, the recent data on inflation are kind of on, surprises are to the downside, not to the upside. That said, look, there is a global risk here, and we should all know we're playing with fire. That the you look at the U.S. fiscal discussion, it's like how much money can we spend? Not how much production can we restore. So I think that there's a sense that there's so much stimulus in the world, both in Asia, in the West, that the degree of stimulus is outstripping the rebound in production. And you ask, how long can this last? Now, I would say, and this touches on the dollar question, I'd say certainly on the U.S. side, that a weaker dollar is probably, over the next year or so, the biggest inflation risk that we're going to face, much weaker than what we've seen now. If this trend continues, we see prices pick up, but that will also have an impact on the rest of the world through the impact on commodity prices, food prices, energy prices, and so on. I think on the domestic side, there are very few countries that will face these pressures. And there are a lot of countries that are willing to step in to substitute for any country that's, where inflation is really taking off. So, there's probably 30 countries where my shirt can get made. And if there's an inflation surge in one, there's a line of countries willing to take over that capacity. That said, I'd say that the risks are more to the upside than to the downside, in the sense that relative to our baseline, which is continued moderate inflation, you just see this buildup of financial assets. You see this sort of full steam ahead globally towards trying to get as much recovery as possible. We could get inflation. And I would say one last comment, that even though all central banks talk about inflation, their targets, what a success it would be if they reached it, that's not really the case. I think that, if we reached our, the Fed's 2%, sustainable 2% inflation goal with the unemployment rate of 10%, that would be a catastrophe. The same issue applies in Asia and in the rest of the world, that you want to get to inflation, but only when you're at an acceptable level of production, an acceptable level of employment. So you want to get there, but you don't want to get there too fast. You want to leave as much room as possible to recover. So I think that this inflation targeting is a two-edged sword. You don't want to get to your inflation target too fast, but you don't want to be in a situation where inflation keeps falling.
It's really interesting, Steve. Thank you. So game out, what you described then as the bigger threat, or I think you said biggest threat, which is a falling dollar. And not to put you on the spot, but I guess this is all about putting people on the spot, right? Like, how low do you think it may go, and how long might that period of decline be?
There's a good chance we're talking about, like a 2002 to 2009 type of decline for the dollar here. What we're seeing in the short term, what we're emphasizing in the dollar weakness is that we're maintaining demand, we're not maintaining production. So out of the last 4 months, 3 months have been record merchandise trade deficits, right? Because we're not producing, but we are importing a lot. At the same time, it's pretty clear that U.S. interest rates aren't going to go up very much. And so compared to the rest of the world, USD assets are becoming less attractive. And in a way, it's almost been a flip around from 4 or 5 years ago. If you thought what kind of made the dollar strong, it was U.S. rates were higher. It's a stable currency, a low beta currency, and the economy was doing pretty well compared to everyone else. And if you said, okay, let's see which country checks those boxes now. You take a look at China. We and our earlier speaker kind of discussed, how Chinese growth is rebounding. We're going to hit new highs. Data keeps surprising on the upside. You take a look at Chinese rates. We expect them to be going up next year, and they already have a interest rate differential, both real and, inflation corrected and nominal against the U.S. And it certainly is a very low, very stable currency. So in what's happened is that China in particular, but, Asia as a group, ever since August, because of the rebound and its characteristics, they have led the charge against the dollar. And other currencies have benefited as well. Now, we're likely to see this continue next year, certainly to the middle of next year. I think at that time, the uniqueness of Asia and China in terms of having restored supply chains and production capacity will be mitigated because the U.S. and Western Europe will be coming online again. But I think we are still in a situation where U.S. Assets and U.S. yields could be unattractive for a while. Our forecast is that we could see China appreciate another 4 or 5% from current levels. We could see Europe go up about 3.5%. But I'd say certainly on the dollar side, the risk is that this move is much bigger and lasts much longer.
Okay. I'd like if I can, because there's questions coming in from the audience. Oscar, maybe you can bring in all our group together now. I think that's going to be Steve, Saad, Bobby, and Sue. And if you can all unmute, but Steve, I'll stick with you because we have a question about something that we've just raised briefly earlier, which is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is something I know you are deeply involved in too, which is trade policy generally. But the question is, in terms of all these deals we've been talking about that the Biden administration might come back to that are Obama era arrangements, what do you think the odds are that the Biden administration will have enthusiasm for some sort of re-engagement on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and how would that work? So I'll take that with Steve, and then we can have the group together.
Well, let me say more broadly that I think the good news is that the U.S. isn't going to take any kind of unilateral measures under Biden the way they did under Trump. TPP, the Obama administration negotiated it, backed away from it because the mood against trade was so strong. Biden has emphasized his buy U.S. policy, which it's not been really discussed at length, but, certainly doesn't sound like a global, friendly global trade policy. I think that they will re-engage with TPP because it's a way of re-engaging with its partners in Asia and kind of getting the U.S. back in the game. Whether they actually go into it, I think, is going to be a different question. I think the negotiations will be longer than many think. Similarly, I think that the even though they won't be raising tariffs on China anymore, that the discussion of how quickly will these tariffs be removed and what they expect China to deliver for the removal, that will be a longer discussion than expected as well. Last thing I'd say is one thing I would look for is to see how they use the various trade remedies that are in the law. For example, Commerce Department last year said that an undervalued currency could be an indication or could be used to indicate unfair trade practices resulting in sanctions. Whether they actually, you know, if they say, well, we're not just not going to use that, that makes no sense, or whether they it's actually a tool that they consider using, I think will be very important in terms of gauging just how deep the commitment is to restoring trade. But I would be a little bit cautious about things improving, even though I'd be optimistic that things won't deteriorate from here on.
Okay. Thank you, Steve Englender. Now, if we're looking for a sliver of optimism, I will throw out that we will have something of a return to decency at the highest level of political office in this country, and that will at least begin to repair the United States' relationship around the world. And my own view, and I think I'm swimming upstream on this one, is that Trumpism is going to, in its severest forms anyway, fizzle in the years ahead. Why don't we go in the order that we went before? Saad Mohseini, if I ask you for some reason to be hopeful as we turn the calendar year, what would you say?
I think, which I'm looking forward to is a packed restaurant or a, you know, bar or something. I think that I think we appreciate engagement with other individuals, socializing with them. I actually disagree that we're going to go across the point of no return. I think we will be more social, more sociable, and more engaged physically with other individuals and probably collaborating work-wise. And that, to me, is something to look forward to.
I can't wait to see you at that packed restaurant.
I'm already going to pack restaurants in Dubai and Kabul. I'd like to do it in New York, though.
Yeah. They just shut down indoor dining yesterday here. Sumi Terry, have you some reason to be hopeful for 2021?
Yes, I'm going to throw out one serious and one not so serious. One first one is that President Biden will conclude these burden-sharing negotiations with South Korea and Japan, because his approach to alliance is that one that's familiar to all of us, more conventional alliance management, more institution-based, you know, going to be a departure from America-first orientation, transactional approach, and all that. Extortion phase is over. Burden-sharing will be done. On the lighter side, I do think movie theaters will survive and even thrive alongside the streaming services, as you mentioned earlier, but because the history of technology is not either-or situation. It's of end. So movies did not place, did not replace stage plays, right? Radios did not replace movies. TV did not replace radio or movies, you know? So I think an internet did not replace radio, TV, or movies. So I think, theaters will continue to exist. They were, people will go again because they offer a communal experience and a viewing experience, bigger screens, better sound than you can possibly get home. Oh, one more thing. Tokyo Olympics will be held as planned with vaccinated crowds in attendance. Vaccines will be widely available next summer. Holding Olympics will be an international priority as a sign of normalcy. Japan will have a lot invested in this, and they will have resources to vaccinate. So that's another positive news.
Oh, you're making me feel so much better. Bobby Ghosh, what have you got?
Yeah, I'm just trying to visualize what Sue just said of an Olympics in which the spectators are taking drugs and the athletes are not. but that would be a fine thing. I'm also looking forward to attending, to going with Saad Mohseini to those crowded restaurants, wherever they may be. if I may, the two things I'm optimistic about, one in general terms and one very specific. Generally, I'm optimistic about science. I think 2020 has, despite all the sort of counter messaging from populists, from Trump on downwards, 2020 will be at least the second half of 2020, the last bit of 2020, and the first bit of 2021 will be looked back. I think we'll look back on it as the return of science and the vaccines, the administration of the vaccines, and the recovery that they will bring will, I think, give us a new appreciation for what science does for mankind. From a little more specific to the part of the world that I was covering in this discussion, I'm very optimistic about Bangladesh. Bangladesh is already almost there, and I think in 2021 will become the most successful economy in South Asia. That has not happened in Bangladesh's entire existence. And that is a sobering note for its bigger cousins, India and Pakistan, as they struggle with their economies. Bangladesh, per capita terms, growth terms, will be the success story in a very bleak time, it has to be said, but a success story for South Asia.
Thank you, Bobby Ghosh. Steve Englander, you get the last word, and it's got to be an optimistic word.
Well, I'll give you one serious and one not serious and let you decide which is which. Look, I think I'm more optimistic about the emerging markets world than any time over the last decade. And for two reasons. One, a weak dollar, it may reflect weakness in the U.S., but it's actually great for emerging markets. It means that their debt problems are mitigated, their external debt problems are mitigated. It means that commodity prices are higher, which by and large is good for EM. And I think that one of the things that's not going to change, our best, you know, personal protective equipment is our car, our homes, you know, in addition to masks, obviously, and so on. But the shift in demand that we're seeing away from services towards tangible goods. You know, housing is booming like it hasn't done in 15 years. It requires tangible inputs. People buy cars, furniture, everything when they buy a house. It's true not just in the U.S., it's true elsewhere in the world as well. This is a shift in demand. Marginal demand in the world is going to be for tangible goods, which is very good for EM, not services, which tends to be much more domestic focused. The other piece of optimism that's out there is I really do expect that by the fall of next year, I'll be able to watch the New York Jets lose in person as opposed to, you know, sitting in my living room and watching them lose on my flat screen. So there's a lot to look forward to.
Thank you for listening to Asia in Depth. You can listen to other episodes of this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Check out our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. See you next year.